Welcome to Careers in Discovery, your window into the world of leaders in pharma and biotech. Brought to you by Singular Talent, making hiring better for organizations involved in drug discovery and R&D. Joanna Holbrook is the Chief Scientific Officer at Cambridge Epigenetics, a company pushing the boundaries of DNA sequencing to enable precision medicine. Jo joined us to talk about her globe-trotting career, the secret to communicating with non-scientists, and why good science is necessary, but not sufficient. This week, I'm really pleased to be joined by Jo Holbrook of Cambridge Epigenetics. Jo, welcome to Careers in Discovery.
Thank you.
Really good to see you. Jo, we always start by talking about what you're doing now. And so I'm really interested to talk a bit more about Cambridge Epigenetics and the work you're doing currently, the work you're doing to extract better info from DNA and better insight from DNA. So can you tell us a bit about that and about Cambridge Epigenetics and where you are as a business?
Absolutely. Cambridge Epigenetics builds sequencing technologies to sequence the genetic code, ACGT, mm-hmm. and also the DNA epigenetic codes, so methylcytosine, hydroxymethylcytosine. We do this at very high accuracy, at very low input of DNA, and in a phased manner. So we're able to see genetic and epigenetic information in the same read and form the same molecule. We have a product that has just launched, which mm-hmm. is called five-letter sequencing, which sequences ACGT and modified cytosine. We have in the works in very late stage development six-letter sequencing, which is ACGT, methyl and hydroxymethylcytosine. These products come with multiple extensions for low mm-hmm. input, for targeted, etc. And we have a very exciting discovery portfolio, expanding again on the amount of information you get from DNA.
Yes, interesting. And I know that you as a company are supporting lots of different kinds of research. The approach that you're taking where you're looking at epigenetics and genetic code, what are the sort of advantages of that? What does that allow researchers to do?
There's several advantages, and I'll talk about it in terms of applications. Scientists whose work we are trying to enable. I think one of the really proximal ones is early detection of cancer, mm-hmm. Detection of fetal DNA in mother's blood, what we call liquid biopsy. There, the amount of DNA that you can get from these samples and the amount of minority DNA that you're actually trying to measure, like tumor DNA and fetal DNA, is limiting. And so researchers up till now have had to pick whether they want to look at the genetic information, which tells you about somatic mutation or mm-hmm. genetic differences from mother to baby, or the epigenetic information, which is much more dynamic and gives you information about cell of origin, for instance.
Yes.
It's been shown that these pieces of information are additive. If you look, put them together, you're more accurate to make diagnoses, to be able to guide treatment decisions. But it's practically been difficult to put them together. Mm-hmm. Because you have to run separate workflows and you don't have enough DNA to do that. And also integration of that information is very inaccurate after two workflows. We've produced technology that can do one workflow, one DNA sample, and you get the information you would have got from running it three times.
Yes.
But a much higher accuracy. So that's really what we developed it for. That's been the obvious application. What we've seen now, when we put it in the hands of smart researchers, is that there are other facets of the technology which are also incredibly useful. Mm. So most biologists are looking at complex biosamples where they have a mix of cells or a mix of DNA fragments. And if you measure genetics and epigenetics separately, you don't know what goes with what.
Right, understood, yeah.
Our technology, of course, you can put them together and so know that this MethQTL, this SNP and methylation mark that work mm-hmm. together and are coordinated, come from the same molecule. That's opened up a load of applications for us, and we're doing really exciting work with people looking at, for instance, regenerative technologies, so being able to change cell fate and age, which it is specified by a combination of genetics and epigenetics.
Yes, and a growing field, of course.
It is, yeah.
Yeah.
as is DNA sequencing in general. A common misconception about us is that we're building a sequencer. We're not doing that. We're building a sequencing technology, which actually works with any sequencer and any any setup. So it's a pre-sequencing workflow that takes you from DNA to a sequencing library. You can sequence that library on any existing sequencer. It would work with Sanger sequencing. Mm-hmm. We've optimized our first products for Illumina because that's where the installed base is, but it would work with any of the more novel NGS technologies or also long read technologies. And then there's a piece of software that takes the raw data and converts it into meaningful sample level information. That software can be deployed on any compute setup, so a cloud or a HPC. So you don't need to invest in new equipment or hardware. And we're currently building lots of downstream applications to take advantage of this novel type of data.
Mm. Interesting. And so that more nuanced understanding that you can get of disease of whatever type you're looking at, I suppose, from a diagnosis point of view, clearly that allows better, more personalized diagnosis. But I would imagine that as well, you know, we obviously focus a lot on drug discovery. There's insight that perhaps wouldn't have been available by combining those two pieces of information that could lead to better treatment or novel approaches to treatment, things like that.
Yeah, we're trying to empower precision medicine. So I think of genetics as your inherited risk of disease and epigenetics as codifying your environmental risk. We know they work together. We know that you can have, say, a sensitive genotype. And if you have the right environmental influence, that you can see in the epigenome and that leads to disease. Mm-hmm. We also know it's on the causal path. So determining who's going to respond to what treatment and whether that treatment worked can be found in looking at your genetic and epigenetic sequence. I think it's deeper data to really understand biology, but also to guide things like treatment decisions.
Mm. Okay. And so you're up to 6-letter sequencing. How many letters do you think are possible? Where would it get to, do you think?
So in discovery, we have more than 6 letters.
Okay.
The fundamental transition of our platform is we've moved NGS sequencing from a 4-state technology where so you think of Watson quick pairing, normally you can measure ACGT. Mm-hmm. And if you want to measure something else, you have to give up one of those states. So right. You lose information if you convert, say, your Cs to Ts because you're doing bisulfite sequencing. We have converted it to be 16 state. So we have enough states to capture the genetic and the epigenetic states. And we also have states available to do things like error correction, so we can catch PCR and sequencing errors as well. So up to 16 state sequencing in our current platform. And then we have additions to that. So for instance, looking at open chromatin, which would be layered on top of our 16 base sequencing to also look at wider patterns. So yeah, sky's the limit there.
Yes, okay. And so tell us a bit as well, Joe, about your role there. So you're the Chief Scientific Officer. Tell us a bit about where you spend your time and what your job is about.
I split my time, I guess, between talking to the scientists in the organisation. We have these mm-hmm. incredibly talented teams, and I get the lucky job of really just looking at data. So we run in sprints, agile project management. Every 2 weeks, we sit down with all the data we have, work out what we know now that we didn't know 2 weeks ago, and plan the next set of experiments. Mm-hmm. So I spend about half my time being involved in the data and the science and helping sort of organize the progression of our programs. And I spend the other half communicating with non-scientists, communicating with commercial aspects of the business, mm-hmm. With investors, with external companies who are interested in the applications of our technology. And that's part of my job that I've really learned in the last 5 years or so, to be able to communicate the complexity of the science with people who don't have technical backgrounds and have other skills that they're bringing. And I feel it's really important to get that communication clear and crisp. Mm. You need to make decisions that, as a commercial company, that are grounded in the science and what it can and can't do.
Yes.
I also need to get across the progress and the risk inherent in the work we're doing. So we can make decisions based on, you know, how likely is it we're going to be able to get this product out by this time.
And
I need to be able to explain the promise of the technology in a balanced way. So we're not over-promising, but we're also not underselling ourselves. And that's learning to communicate across not just scientific disciplines, but completely different functions has been really fascinating for me, and I think a really important thing. So yeah, that's about half of my job.
No, that's a really good point. And I think, you know, most of our audience are scientists at various points in their career. And so some of them may be going through that transition at the moment, or thinking about roles in the future where they'd need to develop that. Any advice, any particular learns, anything that's been particularly useful for you?
Someone said to me, put the conclusion first.
Okay.
So as a scientist, you tend to lay out, if someone asks you a question, you say, okay, here's the context, here's what is known now, here's the data I have, and that leads me to this hypothesis and conclusion, and here's my caveats. If you say that to a commercial person, what they hear is, she doesn't know, she's very uncertain. So what you need to say is, here's my conclusion.
Right.
This is why I think it, here's my caveats, here's the context. So you go backwards. The way it was put to me is, pretend you're Simon Cowell, tell them they're going to LA first, and then tell them why. And that's been a learning for me. And just sort of balancing, you never want to dumb it down. You never want to use the complexity of it. That does everyone a disservice. But you do need to be able to put it in terms that don't have jargon. And that just takes practice, I think.
Yes. Go ahead. Sorry.
I talk to really smart people who have an intuitive grasp of the evidence, but they might not know all the nomenclature. So I've learned to be able to put it in a way that they can engage with it. And often we get really completely left field questions that make you think, do I really know that? So it's quite a fun process, but it does take practice and learning to do it. And it can feel very uncomfortable if scientists are taught not to make unsubstantiated statements. So to start with conclusion, first couple of times I did it, I felt very exposed and uncomfortable. I've got used to it now. I think I've learned to balance it right.
It makes sense. And as you say, it's hard, isn't it, to sort of wind back years of training. That you've been told to present things in a certain way and encouraged to present things that way, and then to shift that lens is always challenging. But I guess, you know, we sort of, when you think about it from a sort of marketing or copywriting point of view, we call it not burying the lead. So you start with the thing that's going to catch people's attention, right? And then explain everything that goes around it. Good advice. So I always like to go back to the beginning, Joe, as well, and talk about people's journey through their career. And we'll come back to Cambridge Epigenetics and how you ended up there. For you, I know originally you trained as a biologist and got into bioinformatics, and we'll talk a bit more about that. Why science to start with? Why this career? What are the origins of this path for you, do you think?
I always wanted to be a scientist.
Okay.
I was a dinosaur crazy 4-year-old. I used to get a science magazine delivered every week, which had fossils in, and it felt like understanding how things work, and I like the quantifiable nature of it. At school, I'm a sort of questioning personality, and I found that. English, I used to like English literature too, but whether my essay was good or not was very subjective.
Mm-hmm.
My teacher would be their opinion, and sometimes I disagreed with their opinion. Whilst maths is right or wrong.
Yes.
And chemistry is right or wrong, and biology is right or wrong. And I loved that very absolute ground truth that existed, whether we were observing it or not, a reality. And so I was drawn to hard sciences, partly because I resented people with authority telling me what was right or wrong. and I did genetics at university, which I loved. And I think that Mendelian genetics from someone with a maths brain is just amazing, that you can take complexity of biology and boil it down to a sum. So I did genetics, and then I did a PhD in molecular biology. Similarly, I loved, I was working in molecular evolution, and having a theory to explain complexity and to be able to generate empirical evidence that agreed or didn't agree, I thought it was cool. But yeah, during my PhD, I started in a lab. I wasn't great in the lab. I dropped most of my gels. They had cracks in. I often pipetted into the wrong tube because I wasn't concentrating. I was thinking about something else. And as soon as I learned that I could also generate data on the computer, I had a little dial-up connection to the Sanger. I thought, wow, this is much better. better at this. And so I did, my PhD ended up being a bit lab work. I did what my supervisor had suggested at the beginning of the project, which is I was working on a protein that switched its subcellular localization in different species. And my project was to work out what it did in the frog. And I did that. And so I got through all the RNA's protection experiments and all the awful cell culture where my cells constantly got infected. Immunofluorescence. But I also wondered why it switched. And I did lots of sequence alignments to see a positive selection pressure signal. And I was talking about this at a conference, and someone from GSK came up to me and said, do you want to join the bioinformatics department at GSK? We're looking for people to go searching for drug targets in the human genome. And I thought, yeah, I'll pay off my debts, my student debt, I go for 6 months. And I stayed 10 years at GSK. I loved it.
Yes, interesting. We will talk about that as well. So so you started this career, I suppose, in bioinformatics, computational biology, back around 2000. Today, if someone was entering the drug discovery world or the pharmaceutical research world, pretty much every program will have some element of bioinformatics or computational biology. What was the sort of state of it there? Was it quite advanced at GSK? Was it quite new? Where was the sort of the landscape like?
Yeah. I mean, among the pharma industry, I think it was GSK was one of the more advanced ones. But at the time, it was seen as a newfangled thing, maybe a bit woolly. And I got frustrated that the stuff, because again, quite a questioning personality type. I really liked genomics because it felt very hypothesis agnostic and very, you know, you could look across the entire genome and rank targets based on certain criteria. So I was doing target identification when I first got there and validation. And I was doing, and I had all these large hypothesis-free, unbiased data sets. Whilst drug discovery worked very much, the pharmacologist was king, and we did validation experiments as had to always be done, with a hypothesis to start generated from the literature. And my stuff got sort of added into programs as supporting information. It was valued, and you know, there was very practical things I could do, like find the author log so we could clone it for the mouse model or something, but it didn't really change the direction of the programs. It was still just sort of an add-on to support the hypothesis, and so I moved from the bioinformatics department to running drug discovery programs. I pitched a few targets. I now think I was very kindly mentored by one of the pharmacologists. I didn't quite realize that at the time, and ended up running the programs for the part targets I pitched, where I got to put the data front and center. And I also got to work on programs that had to move forward. The cadence of drug discovery and development is relatively fast. Programs have to move. You have to make decisions based on the information you have, which might not be complete. And they're very multidisciplinary. So I got to communicate with people outside of my particular discipline expertise, you know, biochemists, medicinal chemists, clinical scientists. And I found that fascinating. and really fun to have people who are experts in different areas trying to pull things together. And that's what kept me at GSK, first in urology in the UK and then in oncology in the US.
Yes.
I follow the data. It looks on my CV like I did it on purpose. It was actually a lot of luck, but I moved into drug discovery at GSK just when the human genomes were coming out and we were GPCR hunting, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Then I moved to oncology in the States when all the cancer genomes were coming out. And we had the substrate for targeted therapies and the beginnings of precision medicine.
Yes. Yes, so timing is often everything in these things, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you've touched on it there. I mean, you went there thinking you'd be there for 6 months and you were there for 10 years. And it sounds like some of that was around the progression that was available and the variety of the work you were able to do. And I'm sure there's a lot that you learned along the way as you were doing that. If people are looking at, so some of the question that we encounter quite a lot for people who are in the early stages of their career or coming out of academia, for example, is should I go for a small company? Should I work for a big company? And you've, of course, done both. What do you think were the advantages of going into a big company to start off with? What did you experience there?
Yeah, there's pros and cons. I think GSK was really good for me. I moved into an apartment where there were a load of experts. So I wasn't the bioinformatician in the company. I joined a huge bioinformatics department and I learned a lot from them immediately. You get to be a specialist because you can go work, I brought the molecular evolution stuff and I got to get really deep into that. I didn't have to worry about any of the operational matters. Mm-hmm. That just didn't touch me. There was huge HR departments, there were huge operational departments. If I wanted to build a biochemical assay, I could go talk to some of the best biochemists in the world who had huge infrastructure set up already. So all of that operational stuff was completely absent, which allowed me to really concentrate on the science stuff.
Mm.
And I look back and think that's a major advantage, which I don't think I appreciated at the time. No. And I got to move around and do lots of different things as well. You get to do that in small companies, but you do what the business needs. Whilst in a big company, you can kind of follow your interest to some extent. The very mature organization as well. I mean, GSK has its own culture, which I think is stronger than the country culture, to be honest. You can
say
GSK is GSK wherever you go.
Right.
And I was given a lot of opportunities and also learned a lot about internal politics. So I sat on the portfolio committees and learned why drug programs really go forward or not, which is to do with the strength of science, but also to do with the strength of the advocate, the program leader, their ability to tick the boxes that the committee is looking for. And that was really educational for me. That's not dissimilar to how grants get funded in academia or to how biotechs get funded. But it was quite transparent in a big pharma, and I think that was helpful.
Yes, I see. So it was your observation that sort of the opinion of the committees was often that if the right person is running the program, they'll figure out a way to make it work, even if it's not quite as strong. It was more about the
I don't think that's what they said to themselves, but
no, of course,
it was clear that a program leader who could make the committee trust them, who could present the data in a way that was persuasive, who was savvy enough to pick up whatever the latest trend was in what really matters in validation and make sure they had ticked that box, got their programs forward, and they couldn't do that without having some decent science behind it, but that was necessary, but not sufficient.
Yes, understood.
And that, I think, I've realised is true everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, I was outraged at first. I was like, well, why isn't this done in a completely impersonal, evidence-based method? And I still kind of think that. I mean, it shouldn't be personal, but all human organisations are. as I've got older and more realistic, I've transferred some of those learnings about it really matters how you communicate it.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because as you say, you know, a lot of scientists, I think, get into science because they like the right and wrong of it, the black and white of it, the concreteness of it. Of course, as you go into more novel science, I suppose some of the edges are worn away on that, and there is a bit more ambiguity. But ultimately, it's still, like everything else, it's still an industry that's run by people, right? And so there's always going to be that element of convincing people, persuading people, tapping into people's beliefs about things or beliefs, you know, beliefs not about things or what have you. So it's interesting to see that.
Yeah, and you've got to believe in your program, in your process, and your product, not beyond reason, yeah. You need to take the evidence, but you also, there's some need to push your particular hypothesis until it's properly tested, yes. And that requires a little bit of belief and positive thinking, and I saw that it was very interesting moving from the UK to the US, where US was slightly more positive many things, and the difference in the speed of the work and how people deal with caveats and counter evidence, probably not different in reality but different in tone.
Okay.
And it made me think about how much positivity and how much belief is needed to get programs moving.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you found it, or even within the strong culture that you had within the company, that there were some cultural differences that existed.
Oh yeah, UK US differences, mainly in also in directness of communication.
Okay.
I learned to be I first got to the US, I used to say things like, I think it'd be a good idea to check this out, by which in the UK means, can you do this please?
Yes.
In the US it means, she thinks that might be a good idea.
Right.
Not I'm gonna do it. And it took, I had a process of months to just get a lot more direct in my communication. I learned to stop saying that's interesting and say I don't think that will work. And then I moved to Singapore, where I went completely, Singapore is more like Britain in how codified we are and how we talk. I then had to move it back again.
Yes, and I'm interested to talk about that transition as well. One of the things, when I moved out to the US for a little while, one of the things that I first noticed was that nobody says goodbye when they finish a phone call. And at first I thought it was really rude, and I thought I was like annoying everybody that I was speaking to. And and then you just realize that they just don't, it's just a cultural thing, isn't it? But you're right, you know, the directness is.
Yeah, people. I kept answering people when they said, how's it going? What do you want to know? That took me a while. I realised that they don't want an answer to that question. No,
exactly. So tell us then. So GSK took you out to the US, took you into oncology. Tell us a bit about how you ended up in Singapore.
So when I was in oncology in the US, I worked in GSK's version of a biotech. So together, mm-hmm. with entrepreneurial spirit, I worked in what they call DPU, Discovery Performance Unit.
Yeah,
sure, they're still called those. And my DPU had some targeted therapies where we knew which patients would respond, or at least had a good hypothesis from preclinical. And we spent a lot of time sort of designing clinical programs to genotype patient tumors up front at the time. And I got really interested in precision approaches. We had some of the new drugs coming through, including the epigenetic inhibitors and some of the immunotherapies. And it was really clear that we needed to enrich our trials for responders. And we couldn't put patients through treatment cycles that weren't going to work for them. These are people who don't always have a lot of time and certainly don't want to be exposed to side effects, which they get no benefit.
Yes.
And so I thought, okay, precision medicine's place to be. This is something with my data skills I can contribute to. And I moved from US to Singapore, first with Lily, who had a precision medicine center set up in Singapore. They headhunted me quite aggressively, and for many reasons I quite wanted to be in Asia for a while. I thought, right, this is where a lot of really cool new science is happening. I went to visit Singapore. It was an incredible place. Mm-hmm. And I moved to Singapore with Lily. I was due to start work on the Monday, and on the Friday before, they announced they were closing the Singapore site and opening again in Shanghai. So I went through a phase of learning. So I had 3 months' notice. Right. I helped shut down some programs. So I learned quite a lot about the work that Lily had been doing in Singapore, which was really fascinating. And it's always horrible when there's a reorganization. Mm-hmm. And there were lots of people who were strongly affected, and it was horrible for that reason. For me, because I was sort of emotionally unattached to the programs.
Sure.
And it's, you always, always take them. Any closure personally, it was quite difficult for me to do so because I hadn't actually worked there. So I made friends very quick in the department. I still, you know, keep in touch with a lot of the Lily people who've gone on to do incredible stuff, and got quite a quick overview. And then I realized that Singapore is the best place to job hunt as a scientist.
Okay.
So much cool stuff happening. And actually through someone I'd known at Lily, they said, oh, this institute's looking for a bioinformatician. Well, we thought a bioinformatician at the time. It turned out to be a sort of genomics person. Mm. They've got this incredible data set. They had this large observational cohort where they had a ton of biosamples collected very carefully at different times, so longitudinal samples, looking to do something genomics-y on it, mm-hmm. or testing epigenetics. And they've also got all these industry contracts that they need to deliver on. And I thought, this is a chance to do something quite deep. Mm. I was really interested in epigenetics. I was really interested. I thought epigenetics was the route to precision medicine because it's something that changes with time,
yes.
Changes with disease and changes with treatment. But it's much less dynamic than transcriptomes. I'd had my fingers burnt trying to find transcriptomic markers and proteomic mm-hmm. markers of disease. And at the time, there was just so much noise. And so I thought this is a really opportunity to get properly, deeply into something and also try my hand at academia.
Yes.
I hadn't done a postdoc. I always felt that. So I moved to Singapore Institute of Clinical Sciences and joined a project which was at the time called Gusto, which was a massive observational birth cohort. Mm-hmm. And there again, my time was split between building a lab and doing some quite fundamental epigenetics work. I was really interested in the contribution of genetics and environment to epigenomic marks and whether this could be used to track disease and treatment.
Right.
And then also working with some of these industry partners in producing data sets and analyses to their milestones. And that felt mm-hmm. very much like my bread and butter.
Yes.
So I got to do that and feel like I was being useful whilst also getting to do some explorations into epigenetics and biology. And that worked out really well. I was there 5 years, built a lab, which I think was very good. I still do. All those PhDs and postdocs have gone on to do great stuff. Mm-hmm. Wrote some papers that I'm still proud of. And also, again, learned, I'd run quite a lot of external collaborations at GSK from the mindset of an industry scientist.
Right.
And rolled my eyes about how slow things were in academia. And then I did it the other way around. And I was an academic going, these industry people are so unreasonable. really, you know, all of those collaborations worked out really well. They actually an interventional clinical trial was started from some of the work that I and lots of others did in Singapore. And it enabled some really fundamental work on epigenomics and on gut microbiota. So it was a good time. I would thoroughly recommend Singapore as somewhere to do really good science.
That's interesting. And of course, ASTAR and some of the institutes out there, they're very well regarded as well. And Did you feel, so you mentioned there that you didn't do a postdoc, you went straight from your PhD into GSK. You know, a lot of people who make the industry academia transition do it the other way around. They do some academic work and then go into industry. Did you feel there was any, did it give you a different perspective going the other way around, having spent that time in industry and going back in, or was there any sort of...
Made me very nervous. Okay. I had a big imposter syndrome going into academia. Right. And I'm pretty sure there were people going, where's her publication history? I had always published in industry. Mm-hmm. It did feel strange running a lab. But actually most of the skills are transferable quickly. And I found, yes, okay, actually, I need to do the same stuff. I need to find testable hypotheses in these data and I need to write them up in a way that can explain to others. There were some culture shocks. So as a PI, you're kind of a small business owner.
Right.
So I said at GSK, you get to specialize. Running an academic lab, even somewhere as well-funded and well set up as A*STAR, you need to think about everything. So recruitment is down to you. Mm-hmm. The building regs are down to you, making sure that you're compliant with all of the human tissue legislation. That's all down to you. And so I generalized very quickly. And that was a bit of a shock. I was used to, in GSK, you turn up to a different business unit, a different department and say, I'm doing this in my program. I think you can help me. And they will help you because it's the same company. Yeah, there's politics. Sure. But you generally get, it's quite easy to get people to, help you in your programs. It's not true in academia. I had to make a case, if I wanted to collaborate with the group, what's in it for them? That also wasn't my experience as a PhD student at UCL, where I used to just knock on someone's door and people will always help.
Yes.
Me. But as a PI, I needed to build alliances and talent spot a lot. I had to sort of work out who I could, who I could work with and, where there were synergies. So I think that's true of academia across the world. I think I got quite a gentle intro because Singapore is a very small place. Like, mm-hmm. Everyone's together and everyone knows each other.
Yeah.
And also a very collaborative place. And I was working in the big collaborative programs. But still, that was new to me, coming out of a big company.
Yes, I see. Yes, a very different experience. And then you... So you were there, as you say, for 5 years and you came back to the UK and got involved in some of the sort of, not the first wave, but one of the waves of machine learning, artificial intelligence approaches to drug discovery and development.
Yeah, not immediately. So I moved back to the UK from Singapore and I took up a professorship at the University of Southampton.
Yes.
And I was working with so we were part of a consortium, which was Singapore, Southampton and New Zealand.
Okay.
It was people I'd worked with in Singapore, really great scientists, and I got to go work with them. Again, I was looking at epigenomic trackers disease, but I was also involved in some big data initiatives in Southampton, mm-hmm. where we were trying to get NHS data into research cohorts and do learning from there.
Yes.
I'd always been interested in machine learning. Bioinformaticians have been doing machine learning for decades. We just
called
it something else. But yes, the hype had really started. And I was called actually by someone I used to work with at GSK to say, I've just joined this cool biotech. They've made this knowledge graph and they've integrated all these different types of data. And I said, yeah. People always say that I've written that in grant proposals myself. That's not actually possible to get done. But they're trying to do drug discovery in a data-driven manner. Mm. And as I've probably has been a theme, I'm very interested in doing things in a data-driven
yes.
manner. So I went to visit Benevolent AI. I sat down with Mark Davis, who was one of the builders of the knowledge graph.
Mm-hmm.
He sat me through what they'd done to integrate all these different data types. And I was amazed they'd actually done it.
Right.
Again, it's something that, we always talk about, but they pulled ontologies from all over. They had created all these entities in a knowledge graph and then they'd used natural language processing to read the scientific literature and make links between these entities.
Mm-hmm.
Just this incredible piece of work had been done, and they were now layering on drug discovery and development programs to be powered by this very large, relatively biased data set. Oh, that's super cool. I joined this biotech, didn't know much about biotechs, didn't think to ask anything about what's the runway, who are investors, what share options do I get. I just didn't ask any question like that at all. Turned out I was quite lucky because Benevolent was doing quite well.
Yes.
None of those I even considered. I was like, will I get to start any drug programs? What programs do you have that have good translational models? What I really felt was that the graph was lacking omics data.
Mm-hmm.
There's this huge, deep, perfect source of data for machine learning, and it wasn't really being integrated at the time at Benevolent. So I joined to sort of add the omic data to the graph and to just get to use this information to run programs. I joined some of the drug discovery programs that were going. I started a few new ones, and I worked on the omic data in the graph. They have this incredibly skilled group of machine learners and bioinformaticians at Benevolent, and I was able to just go and say, hey, don't you think we should do molecularly defined nodes? There's all this data here. And they'd sort of go, oh yeah, let me keep going. And a week later the data had been ingested. It was so fun. And then I set up the precision medicine arm of Benevolent, something that you can do very well if you've got all the data integrated already.
Right.
And you can say, I know what this drug does. I know what its targets are. I can see all those lines in the graph, and I can see what diseases those link out to. What should be there? What links should be there? Is there a biomarker that defines the responders maybe within and between disease groupings? And so they again had the substrate to do that. There was a lot of pharma companies who were very interested in finding new novel indications or the responder groups for their drugs.
Yes.
And of course, at Benevolent, they've got the chance to do it from the very beginning. So to define a group of patients who have the same molecular mechanism of disease, endotype, as we called it. So not taking into account the very old fashioned disease terms, which are really very imprecise. That's a group of people with disparate symptoms that have been historically sorted to the same bit of the hospital. So actually taking the molecularly defined dysfunction,
yes,
so molecular cause, and then finding drugs especially for that. And Benevolent have endotype specific drug programs. And I thought that was, rather than retrospectively trying to find your responders, drugs for that. So we did cool work. We did a Series D. I had a quick entry into the biotech world.
Yes, no, it's good. And I think sort of following the trajectory of your career and the themes of your career, it completely makes sense how you've ended up working somewhere where you're now looking at improving the data and improving the insight from that data and working with the raw material, as it were, to drive that research. I don't know how much of that would have been a deliberate threat, but we tend to see when we look back that those things exist, right?
Yeah, I see it in retrospect. At the time, I just think that's really cool.
Yeah,
I think I could help. And I think with KGX, that was the same. I thought that's really cool. That's integrating epigenetic and genetic data at the start, which I had realized by then was very important. I'd done quite a lot of work in Singapore on genetic and epigenetic influences on disease and realized that it's not two separate factors that are additive, it's that they work together. And I'd done a lot of stuff at Benevolent about the analytics of how you combine these signals. And the idea of actually doing that from the beginning was fascinating. Also the concreteness of what Cambridge Epigenetics is doing, that it's actually a cardboard box, which is a kit and a piece of software that is very defined. When I joined KGX, they just finished a large observational a cohort. So again, lots of data to get right at the beginning, showing that this sixth letter, this 5-hydroxymethylcytosine, is really important. It's a mark that Cambridge Epigenetics has a long history, lots of expertise, lots of IP around. And again, it's an extra complexity of the genome that people have been ignoring.
Yes.
That gives you lots more information. And so I was really attracted to the science at Cambridge Epigenetics. And then subsequently, I realized that, yeah, okay, it kind of follows that same trajectory of wanting to do something real, I guess.
Yeah, so it's, I suppose it's rare in this industry that you get to a point where you're creating something that you can touch. There's a lot of impact there, but often you can't physically see it, right?
Yeah, and in drug discovery, and certainly you, it's decades away.
Yes.
You know whether it will work or not in clinic, but you don't know it at the beginning. And you don't necessarily have influence across all of that trajectory. At some point, you just have to hand it over. So working at something that's actually on market now, that's fun.
Yes.
To me.
Yes, I can see that. So you've taught Joe about some of the things that you've learned over the years around communicating to different types of people about the influence, I suppose, of people on commercial science, certainly, and other types of, academic science as well. Is there anything, if you were talking to someone who was starting out on their scientific journey or starting their career, or perhaps if you were thinking about the things that you would have liked to know at the beginning, is there anything that you feel has been a key lesson for you or key piece of advice that you'd give?
My best advice, a boss I had in the States, Rakesh, he said something to me which was a bit like a light bulb. He was a very impatient man. And he would go into meetings where we'd be debating how we move forward in the program. And there wasn't really enough data to make a decision. So we're just opinions. And he'd say, all these options have a high risk of failure. But if you sit here debating them and do none of them, you have 100% risk of failure.
Mm-hmm.
Just pick one and go. And I constantly use that. I work with people who are very expert and very careful, and we often spend a lot of time debating our options. And I, Rakesh's voice, I always think everything's hard, just pick something, throw everything at it, and it will work or it won't. But if you try and spread your bets and not really try anything, it won't work. And I wish I'd heard that earlier in my career, so that's useful advice. The other thing I'd say is that companies and universities, they're big or small, they're vehicles to do good work and to do good science. Follow the ability. You want to be somewhere where you have the resources and ability to do really good work, and you get to work with really great people. That's probably more important, it is to me at least, than the infrastructure you're doing it in. And that, you know, pick your options based on doing something that you believe in with people that you want to learn from.
Yes. It's interesting because I think what you've touched on there is that, you know, your best chance of doing the work you want to do could be as a program in a very large organization, or it could be the program that a company's focused on, right? Is that bit's less important, but
yes.
It's interesting, you know, someone mentioned this to me once, and I use it quite a lot. I've flagrantly stolen it for conversations that I have with people, but basically said that, you know, don't worry too much about the name above the door or the exact details of your benefits package or this sort of stuff, because at the end of your career you won't remember any of that stuff. What you'll remember is the work you were doing and the people you were doing it with, and that's really echoed in what you've said there, so it's really good to hear.
I'm going to flagrantly steal that as well now.
Yeah. That's fine.
That was much more succinct than how I said it.
But it's also, it struck me as you were talking about the advice that Rakesh gave you, that decision-making is always challenging. But it's a unique challenge in the type of work that you do, in that there is such a high failure rate that you're choosing between, you're not choosing necessarily between great options that all have a fantastic chance of success. You're sort of trying to choose the least risky amongst a series of risky options, right? And it that must be a different type of decision.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you don't necessarily want the least risky either, because sometimes risk has the highest reward.
Yeah.
I feel a lot of responsibility for the people I work with, because people work really hard and are good. You want to know that the business plan is going to do justice to the science. So I want us to make decisions, because we will fail otherwise. And I also want those decisions to be understandable and explicitly explained, because I think to keep people's respect and passion for what they're doing, you need to understand why the business has done this. It's sometimes annoying if it closes down something that you were very keen on, but that's okay if you understand why and rationalize the high strategy. So I always think, will I be embarrassed explaining this decision to the team or to other stakeholders? And if I feel that I can do that whilst keeping every morsel of my self-esteem, then it's the right decision.
I think that's a good bar to judge it by. So we talked at the beginning about some of the work you've done very recently with Cambridge Epigenetics and the insight you've been developing. To finish off, tell us a bit about what's next, Joe, for you and for the company, and what does the rest of this year and beyond hold?
Well, it's really exciting phase, because I said our product's out of manufacture, it's past QC and it's in people's hands. Mm-hmm. We're working with a handful of really world-leading KOLs, we call them, key opinion leaders, so scientists who are very influential in their fields, who are very savvy about new technologies. I mean, the first thing they do is benchmark us against everything else they've ever touched, and we've learned a huge amount from them. And this year is really about putting the product in their hands, learning from them, you know, what we need to tweak and optimize, but also what the real applications are. You know, we can hypothesize internally about where we think the product has benefits, and that's quite easy at the moment, because no other technology that does what ours does. So we see that space, but we will learn so much more from the real researchers in those fields, and we expect to make modifications, make new products in response to that before going higher volume next year. So we're scaling, we're hiring, very interested in molecular biologists, enzymologists, physicians, software engineers, data scientists, people interested in working on something very real, something very high science. We're going to double the amount of scientists in the company this year.
Wow. So
it's fast paced, but it's fun. We are likely to be bringing out novel products in the next couple of years in response to what we've learned from the early adopters. And we will be producing scientific publications, known and with our collaborators, really evidencing the utility of it. So going out to researchers and to commercial researchers as well, with real evidence-backed pitches on our products. So that's quite a fun thing to do. I'm talking to scientists now again, but across organizations.
Yes. Yeah, interesting. So there you go. If you're listening to this and that sounds like your cup of tea, then find your way to Cambridge Epigenetics, and I'm sure Joe will be pleased to hear from you. Joe, thank you so much for joining us. It's been great to have you on. Best of luck.
Thank you very much. It's been fun.
Thanks for joining us on Careers in Discovery, and don't forget to subscribe for more insight into the world of drug discovery and R&D. Do take a look at our sponsors, Singular Talent, and their mission to make hiring better for companies and individuals in drug discovery and R&D. You can find them at www.singulartalent.io. See you next time.